Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hello, everybody. Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. I'm speaking with Gina Bhatia. Is that the correct pronunciation? Did I get it right, Gina?
Nearly. It's Gina Batty.
Oh, Batty. Yeah, I was thinking, yeah, I was doing more of a French twist on it, I think.
Yeah. It's okay. I have got French heritage. So that's, you must have picked up on that. It's all good.
Yeah. It's because we've, I'm no big French expert, but I figured like the spelling was a bit French. So I figured I'd say it in my best French way, which is not that.
So that was
great.
Your French accent, right?
My French accent. No, this is my French accent. That's my French accent. That's my cliched French accent. But hey, let's not start off with silly accents. Let's talk about you, Gina. So
let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. Like so first of all, let's talk about the weather where you are today. Just before we talk about like serious things, where I always generally ask people, so people get like a visual of like I'm in Brisbane, Australia. Whereabouts are you?
I'm in the United Kingdom. So I live between two big cities, Leeds and Manchester. And the weather today is very grey. It is raining quite heavily. And I think it's around 10 degrees Celsius. So it's not very warm here.
Ah, right. Yeah. Well, it's actually a little bit grey here today. So similar, but also different. Pretty rainy, but it's starting to get warmer. So.
But you're in Brisbane, Australia. So that's a bonus.
Yes. Yeah. The Sunshine State in Queensland, yeah. As they say. Yeah. It's a pretty good place to live. I can't complain. But it's night here and it's morning there. But first of all, thank you, Amya, so much for being on the podcast. It's really great to finally chat. We were going to chat a couple of months ago and we had to reschedule. So we finally got there, which is awesome. And so I guess for people who haven't listened to you or heard about you or read what you do, could you give everyone a bit of an overview and an insight into what you get up to? And I guess just like the short version to start off with of how you got here to where you are now. Like, what were you doing beforehand to get you to this point?
Yeah, sure. So official title is CEO and founder of the Psychological Safety Institute. I've always been a teacher, so I started off my working life as a teacher, and that is the reason I got into doing what I do today. So there was two separate incidents that happened very early on in my career that literally have shaped the entirety of the rest of my career. So the first one was, imagine this, right? I'm 22 years old, 4'11" tall. Sadly, I haven't grown since then. And I was working with dangerous criminals, right? So you can imagine my workplace was hostile. It was aggressive. It was a very nerve-wracking environment to be in. And I was teaching people who'd been involved in offences related to things like, drugs, alcohol, theft, sexual offences, offences against animals. You know, it was pretty grim, to be honest. Mm. But from the very first day, my protection, my safety and my well-being were taken hugely seriously by my employer, because it had to be. You know, it could have been a matter of life and death in any of the situations that I found myself in every day. So long story short, I was in this role and then one winter's night, I was followed back to my car by somebody, didn't know who it was. I was being stalked. It was a very dangerous man, and it was a very, very scary experience. It ended up with me being stalked for it might have been about 2 weeks. Now, as you can imagine, I reported it straight away to my employer. They were on the phone with me as I was walking back to my car, because it was that scary. So they made sure I had everything in place to make sure I was absolutely safe in any moment of my working day. They put loads of stuff in place to make sure that that happened. So in terms of that, obviously they dealt with the guy eventually. He was recalled back to prison. I carried on my job. But that had a huge impact on me, just having that experience as a young person and feeling so terrified in those few moments when I was walking back to my car. So that kind of was the first instance that got me thinking about safety and what that means and how we can create safer places for people. The second incident was I decided to leave that job behind. As you can imagine, that kind of environment has a toll on you, both physically and mentally.
Yeah, I'll bet.
So I decided, yeah. It was, even now, like what am I, 40? I just have to count on my fingers. You have to count on your fingers how old you are.
Yeah, I don't think about it too much, to be honest. It's funny, but I can only imagine. It's like when you do something else your whole life and you hear like somebody like yourself, I'm sharing these stories, and you try to imagine these things and like, you know, no doubt the reality is always, there's probably like, you know, some level of imagination that you could apply to it, but the reality would be, extremely different, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So anyway, second experience was I decided to leave that job behind. I moved into teaching adults in the workplace for a college. So I wasn't working, as you would imagine, in a college. So when I say I worked in a college, people expect that I'm teaching like teenagers or whatever. That wasn't the case. So what I did was I would go out to people who had a job and I would teach them whilst they were working. So I was getting them up to kind of basic levels of English and maths. That was my job at the time.
Right, yep.
So it's a huge contrast from what I was doing. You know, the environment was a lot safer and, you know, I wasn't dealing with as scary people. They were quite scary still, but not the same level, certainly. on a different scale, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But interestingly, from the very first day of working in this this college environment, I did not feel safe at all to bring my authentic self to work. I wasn't out in the workplace. I didn't feel able to come out. So I'm a gay woman. Didn't feel able to come out in the workplace. And I felt uncomfortable with my manager. And over time, basically what happened is I saw her start to bully people out of their roles. So she had a team of, I don't know, they might have been like 8 to 10 of us, I think, at the time. And she literally picked off one person, waited until they left, and then chose somebody else and started that same kind of behavior to somebody else to the point where it drove them out and they left. Mm. Now, unfortunately, I became her next target. So she found out that I'm gay and that was her thing. So homophobic bullying lasted for about 18 months. And it was interesting because I wanted to report it, but I didn't feel able to because I wanted to get a promotion and I wanted to make the college environment my career. That's what I wanted to do. But it became evident quite quickly that that was not the place for me because I just didn't feel safe to bring my authentic self into the workplace. Nobody really knew who I was. So it carried on 18 months. I ended up getting really poorly. I ended up getting IBS, so irritable bowel syndrome. Which basically led to me not being able to teach in the morning. So as soon as I got into work, I was really quite stressed because that's when it would start, you know, the bullying. I was quite stressed. I ended up being like out of the office for most of the morning, like on the toilet, just feeling really, really quite poorly with it. So I ended up having to swap over my teaching to teach in the afternoons and the evenings to accommodate that because I felt a little bit better in the afternoons and evenings. So again, long story short, it went on for a while. I decided to report it. Can you guess what happened?
You got more bullied?
Not quite. So my manager was promoted, right? She was promoted. Yeah, I know, exactly.
Oh, well,
it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I give the right answer, but it's sort of like a flip side of like a similar I'm thinking though in a way, like it's
yeah, absolutely. It's It's just crazy. It's crazy. So she was promoted and I was told not to progress the case any further because it would highlight my sexual orientation to my colleagues. So HR told me that, right? So I decided to leave. And those two experiences are what set me off on the journey that I've been on since, right? So decided to leave, set up my own business. I've been running that now for the last, I don't know, 14, 15 years. I can't remember, can't keep count. So I run the Psychological Safety Institute, where we are global leaders in workplace psychological safety and culture. Over the years, we've developed a lot of intellectual property, such as we've got a culture framework, we've got a hierarchy of psychological safety, five pillars of psychological safety, and we've also devised a diagnostic tool in collaboration with the University of Cambridge.
Mm.
So that's it. That's where I'm at. We deliver a lot of consultancy training to help people create environments where people can thrive.
That's absolutely fantastic. One of the things that I really like finding out, and I always make sure that I ask, is what I sort of asked you at the start, because often I find in most instances, and it's probably me included, with things that you end up being really passionate about and that you're trying to help other people with, is that the origin story is that's why, as I've gone through the podcast more and more, and I've seen this repeating pattern over and over again, is people's origin stories of why they're doing certain things. It's like the engine behind the passion that then drives what they end up wanting to do, and like putting all this sort of effort in. And you've obviously, and then like you were saying, establishing processes then too, because the passion's one thing, right? And then having it in a structured framework that other people can understand, another thing, which I guess leads me to my next kind of question or segue on that, which is that say now versus at the beginning when you first started, because now we're in 2024, so there's I always find this particular topic really fascinating, because you forget how far, when 2024, which is the timeline in some previous sci-fi films, you're 2024, but you started and you said you've been doing it for 14 or 15 years, and so say from when you began it and you had this drive to do it, what was the what's the right way to say it, the either take up or acceptance or understanding of everything you were talking about then versus now?
That's a really interesting question, actually.
Yeah, is it really, really, really obvious, or was it a really, really slow burn and it's really hard to identify, and you're oh, it just happened really smoothly, or is it really sharp?
That's a really interesting question, actually. So back then, so this is 20, let me think. So 14, 15 years ago is when I started the business, right? So back then, psychological safety wasn't a thing, right? So it's an interesting evolution of it, actually. So I started off initially going in and talking to people about LGBT plus inclusion, right? Because that was my thing. I knew all about it. And people were really interested in that at the time. It was quite a big thing back then. So that's kind of where my training first started. But then really quickly, I realized that actually they weren't that. It was a more generic message that they were looking for. Yes, they wanted to know about how do we make sure our LGBT plus employees feel included, but also they wanted to know how can we make everybody feel included, And it was that kind of revelation that came one night after a very challenging workshop that I delivered. And I remember thinking, this is interesting. Okay, so they're not just interested in the LGBT stuff. They're actually interested in, how can we create safer spaces for people in general? That was the essence of it. And then over the years, I saw that kind of morph into different things. So the first thing was around, you know, creating the safe spaces. Then it was around equality became really big. It was like a buzzword at one point, and everybody focused on equality. Then it was diversity. Then it was inclusion. Then it was belonging. But it's all the same kind of conversation that I was having. It's how do we make sure people feel safe in their environment to bring their whole self to work, but also to be able to communicate effectively, to collaborate effectively, to be innovative, to be creative? How do we create that environment? So it's interesting when I reflect back, I think, you know, I was delivering all of the same messages that I deliver now, but under a different like banner, if you like. So it's quite fascinating. And only more recently has the word psychological safety kind of been taken in under organizations' wings, if you like. You know, they've really kind of scooped into it and gone, right, let's look at this. So now what we tend to find in the Institute is we're delivering a lot more work around how can we, obviously the how can we create a safe space, that kind of thing. But we also do a lot around how can we create the environment for individuals to bring their authentic self to work. That is one of the biggest things that people want from psychological safety. The other thing is around how do we create an environment where teams can thrive. So it's more around the team dynamics aspect of it as well.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess I asked that question too because of the bit that you said at the end too, because I've noticed generally. I mean, it's not just all those things you talked about that are really generally more spoken about. There's more of an open conversation. They're more, I guess you would say they're more, the easiest way is probably to say they're more normalized. Yeah, it's a normal, it's a more normal part. I mean, there's a lot of people that are sort of like, what's that? You know, they wouldn't actually know what that is. There's, but, you know, way less so. And generally that acceptance, which is, I guess part of that is just time of like it being spoken about for a long time. And then people, because sometimes, I mean, what are your thoughts about that? The take up of these sorts of ideas have a tendency. I mean, this isn't a broad brush to paint across everything, but they sometimes have a tendency to be more accepted when, you know, either bigger brands or larger companies or like, you know, more or people or entities that are more prominent, you know, that they either become the first people to introduce like a process, like similar things that maybe that what you're speaking about, they introduce them, then they become, that becomes understood. And then people look at them just because of like who they are. I don't know. I don't have specific examples, but by the nature of some big organization, like say if it was like a Google or like Facebook that have, you know, they cross all their T's and all their I's, and you know, it's generally it comes down after a while, like it comes down the chain into society after a while, you know, it kind of, I mean, it filters down and that helps. Now, do you see, is that something that you've seen, or is that, or I'm just completely making that up?
No, you're not completely making that up.
Oh, good.
The cheekiness in me wants to say, yeah, you've made all that up, but actually, no, you haven't made that up.
And then I'll be, oh.
I'll just sit here. No, I'll just be quiet. No, you haven't made that up at all. I think you've highlighted something really quite prominent, actually. So what we're finding with the Institute is there is a big take up in psychological safety. However, people do not fully understand what psychological safety is. So that is what is causing a lot of issues, I feel, right now. So there is a misconception that psychological safety is all about the belief that your team can take risks, make mistakes, speak up, express their opinions without fear of judgment, that kind of thing, right? Now, that isn't what psychological safety is. It is a personal risk taking, and it's got a much wider scope that often goes unnoticed or is downplayed. So psychological safety is much is a multidimensional in nature, and it is actually a complex aspect of workplace culture. So when organizations are taking it up, they're taking it up mainly with this idea of, right, we want to create a speak up culture. It tends to be that they're leading with that. They don't fully understand what they're buying into, if you like. I did that in inverted commas for those that can't see me. I forget that. So that's the first thing to mention. Okay, so people are buying into it, but with the wrong idea of what it is. So yes, we do get a lot of organizations, the bigger organizations, that tend to take it up initially. So we've seen really good engagement with pharmaceuticals, biotech, financial services, and investment banking. They are kind of the biggest players, I guess, with this. But that being said, the interest is there, okay, and they want to do more about it, but they just want to scratch the surface, right? They don't really want to get into what it actually is. They don't want to make sure everybody feels safe to bring their authentic self to work. You know, they don't really want to think about how can we make sure everybody can communicate better? How can we make sure that the team dynamics are working well, and how can we create safe spaces? No, what they want to focus on is creating this speak up culture, right? And they're not understanding that to have a speak up culture, you have to have all those things in place first, right? So that causes quite a few issues, right?
Yeah, because that can be problematic, couldn't it? I mean, I can imagine, yeah. Like I'm just trying to follow the train of thought, right? And like I haven't, you know, employed, you know, hundreds or thousands of people, but if you've got a big, but I've spoken to enough people who talk to people in larger businesses, who coach them, who talk to their teams, to know that, like, you got to have those underlying, the culture has to be right in the first place, because if you haven't got a right culture and then all of a sudden you introduce what, I mean, I'm not sure if this is the correct sort of analogy, but if you introduce like a seemingly random element which doesn't align with like at the cultures that everyone already has, the culture that you can speak up and it's not like a thing, it's not like, hey, we're speaking up, you know, that and then all of a sudden you don't have that culture and people aren't used to it, and then this rule or kind of thing is introduced, I can only sort of imagine that would be hugely problematic, because and all of a sudden a dynamic that may have just been around, and there's all sorts of like, you know, in groups of people, lots of unspoken things and no one talks about, and everyone's like, and all of a sudden everyone's, hey, it's cool to do this, and no one really, there's no underlying framework for it. Because it's never existed.
There's no safety net for people, right? Yeah. So they're introducing this. I mean, it's a great idea, right? Let's sure, create an environment where everybody can speak up. It's a great a great thing to do. However, if you don't have those foundations in place to make sure people feel safe in the first instance, right? So, do I actually feel safe being in this environment, right? Do I feel safe interacting with this person? Then you introduce a speak up culture, right? If you don't feel safe, if you've got a toxic culture at any of the five different levels of culture within an organization, then the minute you introduce a speak up culture, actually what's going to happen is it's going to become more toxic, and it's actually quite damaging for organizations when they introduce something when they're not quite ready for it.
Sounds very risky.
As you can imagine. Yeah, it is. And that is what we end up mopping up a lot of within the Institute. You know, we've got people saying, we've tried this, it doesn't work, what do we do? And I'm like, well, you need to put the foundations in place. You can't just roll this thing out.
It's like those sort of like scenes, and this is like a silly version of it. To sort of explain by a over example, it's like in those like silly movies where the horrible general or something is going, everybody, or like the king, who's like the despot, is going, okay, everybody, like it's perfectly fine for everybody to speak their mind. And everyone's like, I definitely know it's not fine to speak your mind. Like, we're gonna be executed if you do that. And he's going, No, it's all cool. And then No, sorry if I put like a slight German accent on there, everyone.
What was that?
I don't know. It was terrible. I drifted in and out of German and whatever. So apologies to everyone.
I'll let you off.
Thank you. And apologies to those listening. But like there's the the despot going, it's absolutely fine, everyone. And everyone's like, and then somebody goes, maybe it is fine. And they do it and it's like off with his head, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And
I was just
everyone's
say,
like,
headed,
I knew
right?
it wasn't. I knew like the culture's not right, that the king was gonna do it. You know, and I mean, but that's like over example, but that's would be how it is with a lot of people, right? Even if they don't, you know, off with the head straight away, they'd be like, oh yeah, I'll mark that guy in my book, you know, or that person in my book, you know, that's like, aren't they? Yep, free to say. But like, have you seen or sort of experienced, this is just my sort of tangential brain going off to how these sort of unfortunate ways that some people might use that idea as a way to expose things they want to be exposed, if you know what I mean. Like they go, to get everyone to speak up, but in sort of reality, they're really just wanting to know stuff, you know, from people. They want it to be more open. And I mean, you know, I know that might sound like sort of a negative spin on it, but like I would imagine that would be the case in some circumstances.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, it's confirmation bias, isn't it? It's like you think something's true. You want to introduce something to prove that it's true instead of looking at all of the evidence that proves that it's not true, you know? So, yeah, it does happen, sadly.
Yeah, but it's – I was just going to say that, like, it's – but in sort of principle, like you said before, in principle it's great. Like, it's a great idea, but to then expand, because you were going to then, expand a little bit more to how you, the important part of having those proper foundations. So what do you do in your organization when you're training and speaking to people to help them to have that bridge over to what, to how it should be? Like, what do you actually do?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. So, I mean, the key thing that it's important to remember with us is that we don't have a like one size fits all. Okay. So a lot of the people out there that do psychological safety, they have like, right, this is what we do. And we don't kind of deviate that from that. Other providers tend to be very theoretical. You know, they give very generalized frameworks. We don't work like that. We work very differently. We're very quite creative. You know, we're very energetic, we're very passionate about what we do. So we approach things in a very different way. So how we tend to work with organizations is it starts with a conversation. So they come to us and we go, right, what's going on? Tell us everything that you're observing, that you're experiencing, but also tell us about the data that you've gathered already. Let us know what's actually going on. What can you tell us? From that, obviously that starts conversation, which is great. There's a few different routes we might go down then. Now, typically, organizations won't necessarily have a lot of data around psychological safety. So at that point, we roll out our diagnostic tool. It's called LUX, and it's the one I mentioned at the beginning where we collaborated with the University of Cambridge.
Right.
So it's a survey tool. We roll that out either across teams, like individual teams if they want to, or we do it across the whole organization, depending on what they're looking for. From that, we then get a really good understanding of what's going on within their organization. So our tool measures toxic hotspots, we call them. So it's basically there's 5 different levels of culture within an organization, right? We measure each of those 5 different culture levels. We hone in to find out what are the toxic hotspots within each of those different levels. So the different you'll be questioning what the level is, I'm sure. So I'll just tell you what they are so you know them, right? So the first one is is personal culture. So that's about me as an individual, right? So this is about measuring people's beliefs, attitudes, values, and behaviors, basically, right? We're looking at emotional intelligence, self-awareness, coping mechanisms, that kind of thing. So that's the first level. The second level is one-to-one culture. So this is the culture that exists between two individuals. So like me and you right now, that's the culture that exists between us two. And typically we look at things like the communication that's going on there. Like, how is that? What does it look like? What does it feel like? We're looking at things like trust, respect, feedback mechanisms, conflict resolution, that kind of stuff. Anything that influences like a one-on-one interaction, basically.
Mm.
The third level of culture is a team culture. So instead of it being me, instead of it being me and you, now we're widening it out to a group of people. So a team culture, right? So here we address like the dynamics and the interactions within a team. So we're measuring things like team cohesion, role clarity, responsibilities, group norms, conflict resolution, but within the team this time. Shared goals, collaboration, loads of different stuff around like what you would expect going on within a team. The fourth level of culture then is collaboration. So we're expanding this out past the team now. We're going into, okay, how do different teams come together or different departments or groups? How do they interact and collaborate together? So we cover interdepartmental relations, cooperation, information sharing between the different departments or teams or whatever you've got. Transparency, joint problem solving, that kind of stuff. So there's quite a lot going on in that one.
Mm.
And then the organizational culture is the last one, the fifth one. So this is like the whole culture of the organization. Now, whenever you say culture, people tend to think of one culture within an organization, right? They don't realize that there's all these little pockets of culture.
Yeah, it's used very loosely, the term, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, totally. Yeah. So when people say organizational culture, this is probably the one that you're thinking of more, right? So this is things like it's driven by policies, leadership, overarching values, management practices, policies, procedures, reward systems, recognition, decision-making processes, ethical standards, all of that kind of stuff. All of that fits under that one.
Mm.
So back to how we deal with this, right? So we roll out the assessment tool. It measures all of that I just said, and it tells us where are the issues within an organization. So what are the toxic hotspots that are causing things to disintegrate or to not work so well?
Mm.
So we are able to tell you what those are. We then give you recommendations to say, right, this is going on in this team, in this country, or across these countries, or it might be you've got an issue with your hybrid team or your virtual team or only the team in person in, I don't know, the UK, whatever. So we can pinpoint specifics here to be able to say, this is your root cause. Now, this is what you need to do to deal with that. So we give the recommendations, and that depends on whatever comes out of that. It could be a whole host of different things that we're recommending there. So that's kind of usually our starting point. Now, what we are tending to find, going back to, you asked a question just a few moments ago about the people that are engaging, right? Do you remember asking that?
Mm.
Yeah. So I want to just follow on from that, tying these two things together, right? So the interest is there, right? So people are really interested in this, but the commitment isn't, right? So we might find that 95% of companies just want to do a one-off training session or an awareness thing. So tell us, Gina, what is psychological safety, right? So we do that. We have this great conversation, and then they don't commit, or they don't embed things, or they don't fully engage. And the ones that do are those ones that I told you about earlier. So pharma, biotech, financial services, and investment banking. Interestingly, the sectors that engage the most are the private sector, followed by the third sector, followed lastly by the public sector. So,
right. So
that might be quite interesting for what people to reflect on.
Yeah. Well, I'm following on from that. Have you got any thoughts as to why that's the case? Because I'm sort of trying to go, oh, gee, I wonder why that's, you know, what's the commonality, or what's the you know, what's the thing like outside of the different sector types? Are there any common factors amongst those other sorts of industries? Is it because of the amount of people? Is it because of the more of a type of demographic or mix of demographics, or is it like something else? Is there something that you've identified, or is it just because of because the leadership is thinks it's more important? It's just like as simple as that. Like is it that? Because I know like sometimes, I mean, I'm no expert, but this is, you know, just a observation about like certain business types, and it doesn't have to be like a big organization, is that some organizations are much more like they either listen more because of the leadership type, and the leadership is more, you know, drills down throughout the whole sort of culture, the messaging, or they're more hands-on. Like, is it because there's more of a common factor of that happening in those organizations? Therefore, if someone at the top goes, actually, I really think this is actually really important for all the real reasons, then it's probably going to happen. And then they got good, you know, people under them to go, yep, we'll make that happen. And then they just make it happen. And so it's not those different, what might be like really simple things, you know, like roadblocks that that no one that people like, why is either, you know, A, B, or C not happening in an organization? And it was like, I just can't figure out like the roadblock here. And it's sometimes because the person in like the mail room hasn't, you know, this is a silly example, I'm like, the person in the mail room is just really lazy and they don't send like half the letters, you know, and no one knows that, you know, and you know, and something like some part of the puzzle isn't happening, but those things, there's not as much continuity, which then gets back to a bit of the culture. Like everyone's like, yep, I'm going to do my part. And it's like simple things like that too. So are there like really any like really simple human things that you've observed that are common across some of those organizations? Was it a bit hard to identify?
So here's the thing, right? There is no real robust data for psychological safety, right? So done loads of research into it, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And what I found, and this is going across all the years. So when I first started out, it's the same kind of picture today as it was back then, really. So people are measuring stuff all the time, right? But what we're finding is with psychological safety, they're not really measuring it for psychological safety reasons. They're measuring it for other reasons. So they might be doing like a study on, I don't know, like team dynamics or communication within organizations, that kind of thing. So what we find is that there is some data, but it tends to be tied to other things. And it's implied as a result of that, if that makes sense. So it might be like they're measuring some team data and it comes out that actually, yes, there is an issue. And it's alluded to the fact that there's an issue with people not feeling safe, or that there's like this not, they don't have the speak up culture, because that's what most people focus on with psychological safety. So the data just isn't there. So I recognize this, and this is why we actually built Lux, the diagnostic tool. So whilst the tool is actually giving businesses what they need, the data that they need to be able to look at it and go, this is what's going on with us, this is what we need to do. Right now, we can put some really meaningful interventions in place to deal with all these toxic hotspots that have come up. And that might be involving training. It might be consultancy. It might be, I don't know, a whole host of things. But anyway, so we built Lux with two things in mind. One was to give businesses that data that they need. The other is to collect data specifically on psychological safety on a global scale. So that's what we're doing in the background. We're collecting that data right now. We're trying to find out what the trends are, like what is going on, why, you know, what is making this business over here different to that business over there. So we're actively doing that right now, but I can't give you any answers from that because we just don't have enough data to make it meaningful.
However, yeah, I was just going to say, a few years down the track, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we'll have another conversation in a couple of years and I'll be like, right, I've got it for you.
Yeah, yeah, we'll remember this. And I'll like, hey, Gina, then we're going to.
Tell me this data stuff that you've been doing.
Yeah. That'd be really interesting. Yeah, that'd be great. We'll have to put it in the calendar. Like, okay.
Definitely, definitely. You know, but listen, October. This is what I've observed Yeah, October the, what is it? Can't even see.
2027.
Yeah, that's what we're talking again. But what I have noticed, even though we don't have the data right, this is what I've noticed as an individual going into organisations, right? So it's pretty obvious to me that the private sector would engage more in this than third and public sector. And the reason for that is, I mean, there's loads of different reasons, but I guess public sector, we all know it's stretched. There's not a lot of money in there. The resources are quite, can be quite difficult to get hold of and keep and all of that kind of stuff. And it's a public sector and third sector is a totally different, I want to say kettle of fish, but people might not understand what I mean by that.
I do.
So it's a, I can't think of an alternative. So it's just a totally different environment to be in. Private sector, I can totally see that they would be a lot more forward thinking. They can move things a little bit quicker, and they can experiment a bit more. There's that freedom to experiment and try things out. So it makes sense to me that the private sector is more forward in this than the others.
Yeah, they have the mechanisms, I guess. Hey.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Now, you asked about individuals. I want to just pick up on that, right? So it isn't a case of, like, leaders get hold of it and go, yeah, this is what we need to do. It tends not to be that. It tends to be that there's maybe one person or a couple of people in an organisation that have either heard about it, so they've heard about the misconception that it is, and they're interested in it, and they want to explore it a bit more. It might be that they've had they have some sort of interest in ED&I, so equality, diversity, and inclusion. It might be that they're HR professional and they're really interested in people and understanding people and how we can get create those environments where people can thrive. So it might be those kind of people. It could also be, do you have ERGs over there? So employee resource groups. Mm. Yeah. Most countries do. So it might be that there's a specific resource group like the LGBT one, or you might have a race one or a neurodiversity or age or whatever it might be. It might be that you have an individual within one of those groups that says, OK, we want to learn a little bit more about this as a group. So can we maybe get somebody in to talk to us about that so we can understand it on a bigger scale? That tends to be the foot in the door, if you like. So that is how we generally enter an organization. It's one individual or a small group of individuals that go, I've got an interest. Or it could be also that they've had a really negative experience and they're like me, they're being driven by it. They want to make the workplace a better place for people. So that those are the two kind of key aspects that individuals share, I guess, really.
Yeah, I guess I didn't, because as we've been talking, like I'm usually just like I'm going, oh, you know, I don't know, you know, X, therefore I'll ask Y, and I guess I just ran to the logical conclusion that was the first thing I jumped to was like, well, it would probably like have to be from the leadership. So then it's quite curious to me that then I'm thinking, okay, well that and then you explain it because you've got the boots on the ground and you're there seeing it. And so like you're, you know, no, it's from this other angle, which then puts a completely different light on it for me. And it obviously says, I guess, I'm not sure what it says yet because I haven't got that far in my mind, but that it says something about then how that things go then from the ground up rather than the top down in certain areas. And so
absolutely right.
That's interesting. That's an interesting point because then that's kind of an aspect of, I guess, like then what you might talk to people about culture when you're talking about their culture or finding out about their culture. Mm-hmm. That obviously, however that works in that organization, whether things are like everyone's completely not saying anything and they're being told and they're not speaking out, like even if they even if there's like a bunch of people that in their own personal lives would be quite sharing freely, but they're we want to say under the thumb, or sort of whatever you want to say, but or it's not even that far. I mean, there's obviously a lot of different shades of grey in there with how that works. I can only imagine, but it's interesting that most of your experience is from this other angle. But I guess that makes sense too, because there's always the majority. I mean, as far as the numbers game, probably the majority in any group of people are the middle ground, I guess. And then there's always smaller groups of people at any extreme of opinions and what they're passionate about. And most people, you know, it's a bit of a broad brush, but I think it's probably true, right? Like that most people are on the average, you know. I mean, it's certainly not in every group, because that's not true. Some groups would be like, everyone's like, yeah, it's big, you know, everyone's always sharing, and other people are just naturally get a group of more quietly spoken people together, but they do want to share, but they can't because there's more dominant people in the group. I mean, there's all sorts of
personalities, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
a hugely, I can only just imagine how, like, it's kind of making my head spin thinking about it, about how complex.
Can I go deeper into it for you, just to kind of blow your mind a little bit?
Oh, yeah, please do.
I wish viewers, listeners could see this now, because you're about to see your head explode, right? Right, now let me go a little bit deeper, right? So, like I said, we usually get an individual or a small group of people come to us and say, right, this is what we're looking for. And it tends to be, you know, I gave you a stat earlier. I think it was like 95% of companies literally just do a one-off training thing and that's it, right? So this is what I'm observing, right? So these people are coming in and they're saying to us, right, we want to do some sort of training thing. It's usually around an event in the calendar. So it might be Pride Month. It might be Black History Month. It might be, I don't know, like any kind of National Inclusion Week we have over here as well. So it could be one of those dates in the calendar. So it's usually tied to something that's going to be in the media at the time, right? So they want to put on this this event, and they do it great, okay? So we do this event. We do it's typically a one-hour training thing, an awareness raising of what is psychological safety. And typically what we find is leaders are invited to those sessions, and this is usually like maybe the very first introduction that they've had to psychological safety on this level, like not just it's around speak up cultures, right? So they come to the sessions along with loads of other people from the organization, all across, like across all different levels within the organization, might bring in lots of different countries because we tend to work with a lot of multinationals. So we've got this whole like global thing going on. And leaders are sat there in the background going, this is interesting. This is good. Right. And then they go away from this. But because they're not involved in that initial conversation, unless there's like a real spark in them, like, oh, my word, we need to do something about this. And then they get in touch with the organizers. That's when it tends to just be a one off thing. Right. So unless there's a real like visceral reaction from somebody in the leadership team, it tends not to go any further. So what I'm noticing is if we want this to be a bigger thing in organizations, so not just somebody reaching out and saying, right, we'll just do a little trial, like with Lux, for instance, we'll trial it with one team, see how it works. And then if it's all right, we'll try it with other teams, like trying to get a gauge of the land, right? That's what tends to happen, right? If we want to change that picture, we need people to be coming in from the top and going, right, I came to that training session that you did, and actually you're spot on. We need to do something about this. So let's take this now and roll with it. Let's do something with it. Yes, we can try doing a few testers with little groups and pockets of people, but we're invested in this now. That's what needs to change for workplaces to become psychologically safe. But we're not seeing that at the moment. What we're seeing is this very tentative steps into, all right, let's find out what it is. Let's scratch the surface, but actually we don't rock the boat. You know we've got a toxic culture and that's why we brought you in, but we don't want to rock the boat by making it public to everybody in the organization by saying, this is what's going on. Right.
Yeah.
So
got it.
That's like
that's a key point.
Tension point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
absolutely.
It's, I mean, that would be, I can only imagine Because that then, relates to, heaps of things on a personal level. Like,
have I blown your mind?
Yeah. Oh, I'm just imagining. I have to stop it now because I seem to be feeling like I want to take on all those problems of those business. I'm just so imagining going, oh, that would be like really hard because these people, obviously there's their peers in their industry and and there's competition and there's people and people running organizations didn't get to where they are without like having to do, like work really hard. They're very protective of their brand. There's the whole brand thing then too. There's like the, because brand and like in our world and for the on the design side of things, like that's, I'm always thinking about that. And that's another thing, like I guess the whole psychological safety area in general and a bunch of other things. Brand is also one of those things now which is much more prevalent in people's minds. It's much more, like, oh, they actually, one, and they know what it is, two. Yeah, but, but interestingly, in a similar way to what you were talking about people having an impression of what psychological safety is, they kind of have a certain level of understanding, but they kind of still don't really. That's still the case with, brand. And I mean, it's not only the things we're talking about now. There's probably a bunch of stuff that people have the popular understanding that they have skimmed the surface of, but they can't ever and often won't ever get to that other point until there's some other catalyst like yourself or a friend who's had the experience. Like a trusted person, right? Because that's often it's why somebody more often than not, like if you're going out looking for services or trying to understand something, you might see it 100 times on the internet or someone down the road tells you and you go, yeah, whatever. And then someone you trust or someone in your family goes, hey, and they're like, really? And then they're really listening. So it's like, and I guess in a way, maybe that relates a little bit to like the bottom up idea is that like it might still actually, I don't know what you think about this, but does it still, even though say it's coming from the bottom up, say like a employee, like you were saying is going, yeah, like I want to do this. This is important. Is it still ultimately very important? The role of the leadership, because they obviously have to be willing enough to go, yeah, I think what that person's saying is important, because they're not the decision makers. Ultimately, it still has to be the decision of like somebody else. So there still has to be that they think that's important enough too, right? Like, is that a thing? Like, I'm at the end of the day, like, because they got to go. Yeah, I think that's important, and I'm actually listening to what these other people have to say in my organization.
Yeah, it most definitely is a thing, and I think it's an interesting one because whenever people talk about psychological safety and whose responsibility is it, interestingly, everybody seems to think it's the leadership team's responsibility. However, creating any sort of culture within an organization, it's made up of people, so every single person in an organization has a role to play in it. So you can think of it in two ways, right? You can think of it as like, when you throw a pebble in a lake or a pond, right? You get that ripple effect, don't you? Right. So if I work on me, right? So if I work on my own self-awareness, if I work on my emotional intelligence and understanding my thoughts and my emotions and how they impact me in the workplace, how they impact my behavior, if I become more self-aware, right, then I show up in a very different way to the Gina that has none of that, right? And what happens is when I start to work on myself, people will notice that, right? So they'll notice that maybe I'm being a bit more considered, or maybe they'll realize that I'm being a bit more authentic and revealing more of who I truly am to them in one-on-one conversations, for instance. So you can feel it. There's generally a shift when people start to understand themselves and how they're coming across, right? So it comes back to this pebble thing. So if I start to do that, you will notice it, right? Probably subconsciously at first. But then as you start to think about it and process it, you might have a conversation with me. You might go, what's changed, Gina? You know, like, what's going on? What are you doing? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
As you start to notice it, then you're now part of this ripple and you might start to do work on yourself, right? So it ripples out, okay? So that's one approach. It could be that one person is the catalyst for the whole transformation of the organization. And it could take years and years and years, but that one person was the trigger point for it. The other side to it is we can go top down. So we can go, all right, let's get the leadership team involved here. Let's make sure that they understand the importance of it and let's get them to be role models. Now we've got anywhere between, I don't know, smaller businesses, maybe 5 leaders up to thousands of leaders, right? You've got lots of different ripple effects going on and it cascades a lot quicker and easier because there's a lot of people doing it, right? So we can't say that it's a leader's responsibility because it isn't. Every single person has a role to play in it. And everybody's got to be bought into it. If you have a leader that isn't bought into it, then things will slow down. You know, they might not work as well as they could do. It is better to have everybody on board. However, not everybody is going to get on board at the same time and at the same pace. So you've got to bear that in mind and think about we're all people. We've all got different personalities, different preferences. And you've got to really kind of think about how to navigate that situation of bringing a whole organization with you on that journey. And I think the hardest part is actually people standing up and saying, yeah, we have got an issue and we actively want to do something about it. And whether it becomes public or not, we don't care. We want to make a difference for our employees. But what we tend to find is a lot of organizations don't want to stand up and say, we've got something wrong here. You know, they'd rather brush it under the carpet or do it in little pockets so nobody gets wind of it.
Yeah, and I can understand why. Like I could understand. There's
100%.
Like I was saying, I mean it's risky or well it's ultimately perception then too, right? I mean it's a lot of 99% of things that appear to be risky or you think might happen obviously don't happen. So there's all sorts of things that people think of. I'm sure I do all the time. We go, oh, this could happen or that could happen. I was like, they're probably not going to happen, but they're still powerful and they still like influence just about everything that, you know, all of us do. And they're not particularly logical. And they're often, you know, if you said to somebody else, they're like, what are you talking about? Like, that's ridiculous. And they don't make a lot of sense, but they're still impact. So then it's like that. I guess it's that mix of evidence of providing information to people mixed with personal influence, like you were talking about from people in the organization.
Also, legislation. Levels. Legislation plays a big part in it as well.
Right.
Right. So there's a few countries around the world that have got that have introduced psychosocial hazard legislation. So I can't remember all the different names for it, but in Canada, they've got the standard that they have to that's in place. So the countries are, let me tell you the countries. So we've got the United States, Canada, Australia, Sweden, Belgium and Denmark. There might be a few others coming on board. So I think Australia's was quite recent, actually. But basically, they've introduced this legislation about psychosocial hazards, which basically means that anything that could cause psychological harm to an employee, an employer has to do something about it by law. It's legislation, right? So that is having a huge sway over how organizations think and operate now. We're seeing a huge uptake from companies in Australia being interested in our work because of that. Now, I want to make it clear that psychosocial hazards are different to psychological safety. There is a little bit of crossover in terms of the impact that it can have, but it is not the same thing. but a lot of people are not understanding it right now. They're questioning it. They're thinking, how does this work? You know, it's the fear thing. It's the fear. We could get in trouble if we do not adhere to this thing. So they're trying to find out as much information as they can. And we're getting quite a lot of people asking questions about it. Influence is a big one.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good, you know, I mean, I'm sure there'd be plenty of people out there who'd be like, well, you know, that view that we're being made to do this and we don't want to, but, you know, like it or not, those things which, like, there's always examples of, you know, all through history for all sorts of reasons, for anything and everything, where people don't like stuff that ends up being, you know, sometimes you just have to start the ball rolling and like somebody has to be, whether you say they're brave enough or they're just, you know, have just the foresight and just giving things a go too in that way of just going, okay, well, you know, nobody obviously has a crystal ball and they can't see that, you know, introducing that sort of legislation is going to be the best thing that ever happened to society. But no one's ever going to think like that. But people try it and they go, and then they just got to, you know, see, you know, things have to organically roll out. And then, but it's then enough of a catalyst, which is, you know, I'm sure then generally a good thing. And then there's that, the period where there's like with anything new, things are taken up, and there's rejection automatically, then some of those people go, oh, yeah, now I understand. Then there's a bit more understanding. And then at some point further down the track, like we were talking about at the start with certain areas like these ones now, they're much more commonplace. And then and then you've got, you know, people are probably comfortable enough. Now it's an interesting manifestation probably of that people are like maybe the – governments are comfortable enough with it now after a while to go, we're going to introduce the legislation when they maybe could have some years ago, but maybe it was risky for them too. Maybe they were like,
maybe,
well, like, you know, is that enough of a thing to introduce it as driven by either popular opinion or other factors? You know, I'm not sure what other factors might be, like other more influential people or bodies than them just saying, you need to do this. You know, it's come down to a couple of people, you know, who knows, like, because it's often, often is that, isn't it? You know, it's like you always, there's this impression that big things sort of happen because the amorphous organization says it should happen or has an influence, but really it comes down to a person or some people. Like, it's just it's still just individuals at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess my question is, in terms of the legislation, who was involved in writing that? So had they got some experience in this, you know, did they actually know what they were doing, or were they just writing legislation because that's what they do? They write legislation day in, day out, you know. Are they those people, or do they have an invested interest in this?
Yeah.
And I guess my key thing that I'm always pondering on this one is, okay, so I've looked at a few different countries' legislation, and there's differences between them all, obviously. And I'm looking at it and thinking, okay, so how are they going to, like, check all of this, you know? So there's the rules in place, but they're quite ambiguous. So, like, I could read it one way, you could read it another way, and I could think that my business is adhering to it, whereas you could think that your business isn't, and we're doing the same thing. You know, it's all about interpretation, isn't it?
It sure is.
And unless you're really, really clear with your work, I know, right? But unless you're really, really clear and explicit, which, let's face it, a lot of legislation isn't, then there's a lot of room for interpretation, you know? And that's where the confusion starts to set in for organizations, because they're like, I don't get it. Like, what is this actually telling me I need to do? Like, spell it out to me and I'll do it.
Confusing for people. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what we're finding.
Yeah. I mean, then that it's funny because, like, then when, I mean, so because most people don't, me included, don't have a reason to think about legislation. Why would you? You don't read it. You just get, you know, it exists.
Oh, I'm disappointed now. You should be reading it. Come on. Oh,
No, I'm actually saying I'm actually luring you into a trap. I really do. No,
oh yeah.
No, I was just seeing what you would say, Gina. Gotcha now.
Did I pass the test?
Yes, you did. You could have another podcast. You know. But most people, except for lawyers and people who have a vested interest, and like people like in, like, you know, you who are like, you know, obviously pondering like you are, which is an incredibly interesting question. It's like, okay, were the people who wrote it, who are thinking about it, are they people who've got like some skin in the game? Are they actually like, you know, passionate about it, or are they just legislators, or is it somewhere in between? Or and then it's like anything that you don't, that somebody knows about and most other people don't, it's invariably always going to be confusing. Then unless there's, you know, it's like hard enough, it's hard enough you know, accepting new ideas for a lot of people, and then at your legislator to do it, but then, you know, just, you know, it's going to perhaps, and I guess I just sort of realized there's a question there, is the fact that people, that some people might feel that then they have to do it, is that likely to compound their likelihood of when they introduce it, you know, into their organization, they're going to do it for not always like the really, really right reasons and just do it?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah, I mean,
probably a bunch of shades of grey there, I guess. Hey, there's probably,
yeah, I think so. But imagine,
not like a clear answer, I guess. Like, it's probably, it's always easy to have like a clear answer, but there wouldn't be, like, it'd be, you know, any number of different configurations. Like, people take it on board and they go, oh, just because I've got to do it. And then they'll realize it's great, you know, and then, or take it on board and they still just, I mean, they're flat out reject it, but they know they've got to do it. And then people who are genuinely really interested in, I mean, there's probably any number of different variables in there, I guess.
Yeah. So what's going through my head, right, is imagine that you've got two different approaches, right? So one business, you've got somebody who goes, right, we've got this legislation, we're going to address this, right? We're going to put these things in place, and they do it in a very positive, meaningful way. So this is for your safety. We want to make sure that we're taking care of you. And obviously we've got to do certain things for the legislation aspects of it, right, to comply with that. So there's a positive way of introducing it. And you can imagine that would go down much better than if you addressed it like, okay, people, so listen up, right? We've got this legislation. We've got to do something about it. It's mandatory. We can't do anything. We've just got to do what we've got to do. So then people might look at that and go, well, we're only doing that because we've been told we have to do it. It's legislation. We're not doing it because it's for us. We're doing it because we've got to tick a box. It's that kind of approach, right? Those two different approaches are going to get two very different reactions in the workplace. So I don't know about you, but I would introduce it in a positive way to make sure that you get the most out of it.
I love being told what to do, so I'd go with the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But would that make you feel like resentful or angry or frustrated? Exactly.
I'm the opposite of what I said. I would be like, get out of here. I'd be like, go away. You know, that's my natural response, which it shouldn't be. I'd try to be better and try to think things through properly. But like the natural response, like it's all in the framing of it, isn't it? It's like, it's the framing of the, of it's how it's presented. It's exactly the same thing, person A, person B, person C, but it's like the, you know, you could even say and explain like exactly the same information has been legislated, but I've read through it, I've tried to understand, I still don't understand this aspect of it, but the general gist is that's good for these reasons, and let's all like, you know, learn together to find out like how to navigate it and get Gina on board to help us out.
Yeah, and I like that approach because it's showing your vulnerability at the same time, right? Because it's saying, you know, I don't fully understand it. I'm sure many people in the world don't fully understand it right now.
Yeah,
100%. But we're going to learn, so let's figure it out. If there's anything that you can help with, then that would be great. If there's anything that you think would be useful in this scenario, then feel free to. And this is where the speak up culture comes in, right? If you've got that level of safety as a foundation, then you can have that conversation. So I don't know things. Mm. I'm asking for your help. And if you've got any ideas, if you've got anything that you want to contribute, if you've got any things that you think are going to fall down, tell us, you know, let's have an open conversation. If you do that in an environment where people feel safe and have all the foundational stuff in place, it's going to work. If you do it in an environment where it's toxic and people are just not very aware of what, like how they're coming across to other people, they're not communicating well, then it's going to bomb, isn't it? Let's face it.
Isn't that like I...
Off with your head.
Off with your head, governor. Yeah, exactly. You're going to the stocks right now.
Yeah.
No, but I was just going to like just make a observation, and this is something that I always sort of find frustrating, and it's in the sense that, I mean, when we're talking about these sorts of subjects, there's a very strong tendency like for some people to like just out of hand to reject things under the guise of like, because I heard myself talking there and I said it in a, you know, I was like, and let's all learn together. And I was listening to myself and I'm going, I bet like some people listening to that would be out of hand because they've heard it in some cliched way. They'd reject things out of hand. Even despite the fact that some cliched things, in fact, many things are actually true in that is that it's not either like rule with an iron fist or let's share everything with a bed of flowers. It's like it's neither of those things, but it certainly is like, you know, true that those things do work. And it doesn't mean things have to be airy-fairy. And it doesn't mean things have to be, you know, hard and nasty. You know, it's like somewhere in between where you can go, yeah, we've got to have some rules around this and we've got to like, and, you know, this is probably not going to be easy and I don't particularly agree with this, but what do you think? You know, and you can actually have a middle ground where all that stuff is like absolutely fine. And you don't have to be, but like I do, and you sort of, it's probably why I just don't read, I don't use or haven't actually used Twitter, now X, for years because it was always, it's just a melting pot of arguments, you know, about things. But those sorts of things crop up where people go, oh, you're not on side A, I'm on side B, but everyone's just like, the reality is that when people just end up talking to each other most of the time, especially one-to-one, they just go, oh, you're, you know, just kind of like me. And and that's true. And that's, and then heaps of people are like, oh, that's not true. It is true. It is true. Cause it like, it happens all the time. And then therefore it boils down to at the end of the day, just if you're able to, I'm sure you find you end up just having a conversation like two people, and then that goes out like you were saying before, it sort of goes up in the different parts of the group, like the sub, and then, you know, higher up. But at the end of the day, it's all made up of like individuals and people all just going. And so if everyone, I'm like you said before, like the stone thing in the pond, I mean, that's really true. That's like, you know, that's like an ultimate truth. And it's easy to pass it off as, you know, you hear people like, oh, it's rubbish or whatever. It's not rubbish. It's true. And you can't, it's true because everyone experiences it at some point or another. They go, you know, you end up having, you have an impression about someone for whatever reason, you'd have whatever preconception and you don't even realize you have it. And then you go and then you talk to them and you're like, wow, that was really different. And that's nice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, and yeah, I mean, that's kind of at the heart of like, or at least part of that, I guess, is at the heart of what you'd probably have to, you'd sort of see a lot, right? Like in having to all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I found that fascinating. Thank you for sharing those insights. I think when you were talking then, it got me thinking about stereotypes, right? So something that we talk about a lot in terms of being your authentic self versus being showing up as your identity at work. So just to go back to the stereotypes thing first, we often experience things through our conditioning, the social conditioning that we experienced as children. So we learn stuff when we're really young. Our belief system is in place by like the ages of 6-7 years old. And our adult life is lived based on those beliefs that we literally got set in stone when we were 6-7 years old from our caregivers, from whoever was around us at that time. And unless you start to challenge those beliefs and those thoughts and those emotions that are coming up, then you're just going to have the same reaction that you would have done when you were 6-7 years old. So when I talk about being more self-aware and emotional intelligence, I'm talking about unpicking your social conditioning, really. And well, lots of different things, not just that, but really starting to understand yourself on a much deeper level. So what did impact you when you were a kid? Because those things are what help to create stereotypes for you when you get older. So you, like you said, you went into a conversation, you had preconceived ideas about what that person, who that person is, what they were going to say, probably what, how they would react, that kind of stuff. Now we do that not based on what we can see in front of us, but based on everything that we've kind of internalized over the years. So your conditioning plays a part in that. You'll have got some certain ideas and judgments about what certain people act like and speak like based on what they look like, for instance. There's a whole host of other things that influence it, but just to kind of wrap up the point, really, that yes, we do make those assumptions about people, and it can be quite damaging, actually. It can really impact on people when you're going in with those kind of judgments and expectations. So yeah, just wanted to say that, I guess, really. But going back to the authentic self, identity stuff. So we do a lot of work on this. This is the first pillar of the 5 pillars of psychological safety. So we do a lot of work on this with people. So just very briefly, people tend to think that they show up as their authentic self in the workplace, but they're not. Basically, what your colleagues see of you in the workplace is your identity. It's not your authentic self. So identity, imagine it like this, right? Start off with your authentic self, right? So imagine this, right? A child has just been born, okay? That child is like fresh. They've got no influence on them whatsoever. They're just like a blank slate, if you like. Now, when you're born, imagine that essence is your authentic self. So it's your most genuine nature and essence before anything gets attached to it. It's who you really are, okay? So that's your authentic self. Now, what happens is as we grow up, as that child grows up, as they develop, as they start to process the world around them, they start to internalize things. So, for instance, imagine as a kid, I used to hear all the time, you're really little, right? And I'm like, yeah, I am really little at first. And then the more you hear it, the more you're like, you question it, right? You're like, well, yeah, I am. Is that a problem? Like, is that going to cause me problems in life? Like, do I need to do something about this? What could I do? You know, so you start to question the things that people say to you.
Who says it, how it's said.
Exactly. And it could be a negative thing or it could be a positive thing. But most of the time for me, I heard it as a negative thing. It's the same as if you hear the words you're fat or you're ugly or specky four eyes or any of those kind of really nasty things that kids say to each other, right? But the more that you hear those kind of messages, you end up getting that confirmation bias thing again. So you look for all the people that are saying that's what you are And that's what you internalize. So they're right. I must be tiny. I must be little. I must be fat. You know, I must be ugly or whatever, right? You internalize those messages. But what that does is it creates a barrier around your authentic self. So imagine it as like little layers built. You internalize all of these negative messages. It's like baggage. You're carrying all this baggage within you, right? So when you show up in the workplace, you're not showing up as that innocent blank slate that you were when you were a kid. You're showing up with all of this baggage attached to you, right? So that's why I say what your colleagues see of you in the workplace is your identity. So identity is how other people perceive you and the way that you define yourself based on all of your life experiences. So it's a culmination of everything that you have experienced and kind of formulated as a perception of who you are. It's a curated version of who you are. And you often present yourself with a like a professional mask at work. So you show up as your identity, not your authentic self. So when we talk about bringing your authentic self to work, what we're meaning is presenting more of your authentic self. So unpicking some of those things that have kind of become attached to you and thinking about them as an adult now instead of as a child, you know? So yeah, people said I'm little, but really, what's the impact of that, you know? Yeah, I can see that now as an adult, but I couldn't back then.
Yeah, I feel that's an interesting point, like how you actually ran through that, because I'd also put forward that like your, because I don't think I've ever thought about it quite like this. So I was sort of like trying to process what that would even mean. But I feel like because like whatever happens, like from that point, when you're born and whatever you do and the experiences and who you're with, like almost form like your, what might be defined as your authentic self is really still also a series of different identities anyway. Like that's it. It's or it's an evolution. Like you're never going to like have that original blank slate. But I do understand why you're saying that though, like that's still like that's representative of the maybe like the lack of ego then too, like because like that's sort of as you, because ego not in that sense that it's often used like as in egotistic, but like that's your, that's yourself and like and your, and that's always changing and you're right, you do put on those different identities, brilliant. And like I mean most people don't obviously even realize they're doing it. You just like it's just in order to be able to exist, you're just shifting between this and this. And you're, and so with that in mind, how would you, like, is there a way that you would then define, or is it not really definable, like your authentic self? Like if given that where, I mean, this is getting like pretty into the philosophical sort of realm, but like
you did say, but you wanted to go deep.
Hey, I'm up for it. This is totally my gig. This is like I like this sort of talk, but like but where you like, what does it then mean if this is actually, I'm starting to sound very much like the sort of feeling I get when I watch, have you ever seen Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead?
No, I haven't.
No, it's one of my favorite movies. It's a, who was the, it's also a play, but it's a movie. It's got Tim Roth and Gary Oldman. It's like a pretty old movie now, but it's the story. It's like a story, like a play within a play within a play within a play. And there, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are these two characters in the play Hamlet, but the whole movie is kind of about them from the lens of them as these two friends of Hamlet who are actually characters in the play Hamlet, but it's from their sort of lens, and they go through the play Hamlet through their lens, and they're having these esoteric sort of realizations about life like as they're going, it's like one of the best movies. And I was sort of saying it because it's sort of, I feel like it relates strongly to that idea of, if you're talking about that people, I mean, people say that, or maybe Shakespeare said, or some famous person said, it's just like, I mean, life is a play, and if you're putting on, you're not literally like an actor putting it on, but you're shifting through these different roles that just sort of are created for you, or that you shift in and out of. So therefore, it's like this, it's like a sort of process of self-realization where one day you wake up and you're like, oh, what is my authentic self? Like, I thought that was me all along, but then I discovered some other thing. So then when you say, I guess for people listening who've just gone like, what the hell has he been talking about this whole time with this 5 minutes? I do apologize to everyone. But just to get back to tie it into like a real concrete real world thing that we're talking about on the podcast, that how would you then define, with all that in mind, like what then your authentic self might mean for somebody, if you had to explain it, if you like Gina went, hey Fred Smith, like your authentic self, like, you know, what's a good way to explain that to somebody who hasn't who hasn't been like just talking about it in depth like we have? They're like, I don't, I'm just me, I'm just a guy, you know. I don't like all that deep stuff. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and it's always a question that I'm asked, actually. So just let me start off by saying, right, so we talked earlier about identity versus authentic self, right? What we're not saying is that you need to be that blank slate again, because to get to that point again is nigh on impossible, let's face it, right? Yeah. So we're not saying erase all of your history and do all of that. That's not what we're saying.
No,
right?
No.
So what we're saying is there is a part of you that really lights up and shines inside of you, right? I tend to call it spirit, but not as in like the spiritual, like that kind of thing. I just call it spirit. It's just what it feels like to me.
Hmm.
So we've all got this like this spark within us, right? That is how I define my authentic self. So this, it's that thing that makes me joyful. It's the thing that makes me smile a lot. It's the thing that makes me laugh and just feel really light in my body, right? So one way that I try to explain it to people is, right, imagine for me that you've been working super hard for like 3 years nonstop, right? And you've got a family holiday booked. So you're going on vacation. Your auto reply is on, so it's all switched on. You're good to go. You've handed over everything you need to hand over. The first few days when you're on holiday, what tends to happen is we struggle to relax, right? So you know, you're still a little bit like attached to what you've left behind. You've still got stuff going through your head. You're not quite in the moment. You're not enjoying the things in front of you necessarily in those first few days. Then at some point, something switches. And you start to feel a bit more like your old self. You feel a bit more like a bit more relaxed. You're starting to forget the things that were responsibilities that you've left behind. And you're just enjoying the moment. You're like engaged. You know, you're present with your family. You're doing stuff. You're enjoying yourself. That feeling that you get when you're in that space, that to me is authentic self.
Right. Okay. Oh, that's cool.
And that's what we're saying is you want to take that feeling that you get, you want to take that and we want to experience that when you're back at work. That's almost kind of what we're trying to do, right? So authentic, there's a couple of...
Is it then, I just keep on going off all these tangents with this conversation. it's a real problem. It's a real problem that I've got. Sorry, everyone. You know, maybe, well, it's kind of helpful.
That's why they're tuning in, right?
Well, yeah, hopefully. Hello, everyone. But like I mean, maybe that then does that then mean that then your authentic self in terms of authenticity, because there's it's all these terms once again. Everyone kind of knows what it means, but it's interesting. And I guess I did too, but because we're talking about it now, I'm like questioning, did I actually, like that's actually like I'm actually starting to question, which is good. Like I'm going, do I really know, like really at the heart of it, especially what you just sort of said then, it was like, does that mean, or was a part of it actually mean that your authentic self is one that naturally gives more to everything? Like this is just, this is just all random thinking. I haven't written this down in a book or anything.
Interesting. That's that. It's an interesting it's just perspective, like, actually. Yeah.
Is that, does it mean that, and it was because of what you said, it was like, okay, so if you've had that interesting observation, which is like, okay, that people, that that's what it means to you. And I never thought of it like that. I thought, So if you break that down further, does that then mean that, that what that really represents is that, I mean, I'm obviously putting a very nice positive spin on, you know, to people in general, but I think it's true, is that when people are relaxed and they don't, and those things, like you were saying, those things are removed, and then they just naturally fall into, they're not trying to fall into like, I've got to try to be relaxed, because that would never, it doesn't work like that. It was like, I've got to be sure, but I have to try to be relaxed.
It did.
Yeah. I know, it'd be so easy. You'd just be able to switch on relax. And that's why people drink, I guess. And that's why they do those things to make them do it. But like they, but then does it mean that because you're naturally falling into that state where you are doing that, that, you know, might not always translate to sharing and giving, but there's a part of that that maybe is at the heart of it, that you're, if you're, because that's often a consequence of that then too, if you're, if you're, yeah, I mean, it's probably not as literal. I'm just sort of trying to piece it together in my mind. It's only a part of the piece.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It is. So I guess the other thing to think about with authentic self, right, is that you, when you're on holiday, it's a very different thing, isn't it? You're on holiday, you're with the people that you love, you know, that kind of scenario might be going on for you, right? So you can quite easily relax. You can be yourself, unless you're with people that you would naturally not be yourself with. Like, I don't know, you might have a difficult relationship with, I don't know, your mother-in-law, for instance. So you might not necessarily be as relaxed as if she wasn't there, right? So we have to remember that it changes depending on who's with us, what environment we're in, how comfortable we feel. And this is psychological safety, right? This is how safe you feel in different scenarios. So in terms of, let's put this now in the workplace, because I'm conscious we need to kind of relate this back to people at work. So that feeling, it's that energy that you want to take back into the workplace, right? So yeah, you get back into the workplace, you're going to be in very different situations with people that you might not necessarily like or respect, or, you know, you might not have a good relationship with them. And then there'll be other people that you have a great relationship with. Mm. So your authentic self will express itself differently with different people. And it's all about protecting yourself, right? That we have this natural thing where we try to protect ourselves from any harm or danger. So if I was in a conversation with a manager that I got on with really well, we were, you know, really bouncing off each other, we had a great rapport, then I would probably be more of my authentic self. So I'd be happier, I'd be more relaxed, I'd be chatting more openly, I would be offering ideas and suggestions and really thinking things through without that filter of I'm trying to protect myself, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of one scenario. Now imagine I'm speaking to their manager, so a leader in the department, for instance. Very different relationship. So they might be quite standoffish. They might have that power dynamic thing going on. So they might, like, you might really feel the power differences between you. Like there's that hierarchy going on. Mm. You might also feel that they are quite barriered and standoffish, and it makes you put a bit of a barrier up to protect yourself. So it's like you're wearing a different kind of mask with this person to censor parts of yourself that you don't want them to know about. You might be hiding certain things from them. You might be masking, basically.
Mm.
So different scenarios will make you feel different, and different people will make you feel different as well. So it's not going to be like you're going to be able to bring your true authentic self to every single situation, because that is quite unrealistic. If you don't feel safe, you won't do that, okay? You'll only bring your authentic self to the situations where you feel safe and comfortable and at ease. So just to make that distinction, I think is really quite key.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And then as an underlying thing there too is that, which I guess relates to me even sort of like rethinking if I even understood that myself, like really, is that like in order for people to go, well, I can't bring my authentic self, they kind of really have to know what that even is, right? Like or to some extent. Yeah. And so, you know, it's and I guess that's sort of a little bit manifested in my sort of like out loud sort of trying to process the information on air, you know, going, oh, you know,
you're not expected to, by the way.
no, but I gave it a go. You know, I tried, but like,
listeners, I can see the cogs turning as well. You can't see this, but the cogs are very fastly moving. I'm telling you.
Yeah, there's like a graphic and there's like all these actual cogs. And they're all, like moving, all sort of moving around. And some of them are moving really slowly. And then other ones sort of, they're not very well oiled at the moment. So they're going kind of slow.
But let me pick up on something that you said there then. So going back into the workplace, right? So that I think this is what sets us at the Institute apart from everybody else that does psychological safety, right? So typically other providers that do psychological safety tend to focus in on that speak up aspect of it. They really focus on the interpersonal, so the interactions between people and teams. That tends to be where they focus, or leadership kind of aspects, right? So this is why we're different, right? The authentic self piece. So we fundamentally believe that you have to get pillar one right. So this thing about authentic self and being your authentic self, right? If you don't have that, if you don't have that level of safety that that brings when you are able to be your authentic self at work, then you're really going to struggle to have one-on-one conversations when they get a bit messy. Mm-hmm. You're going to struggle with team dynamics. You're going to struggle with any sort of cross-organizational stuff. And you're definitely going to struggle with embedding yourself in a meaningful way in the organization. So pillar one, authentic self, is the most fundamental part of the work that I believe we do. And there are we have a process that we take people through to help them with reconnecting, if you like, to their authentic self. So we call it the authentic self process. Super catchy, eh? And there's three different dimensions to it, right? So basically what we're trying to do, right, is we've got this person in front of us and we're wanting to unpick any layers that have built up over time. You know, those identity layers that I said, right? We're wanting to unpick those layers that don't serve you anymore, right? So anything that is not helpful to you, anything that's holding you back, anything that's making you really struggle with things in the workplace, they're the things we're trying to unpick and dissolve, if you like. So there's three questions that we ask people, and these are the three areas of work in the authentic self process. So we go, first question is, what affects my performance and behavior at work? So when we do that, we start this process of self-reflection, right? So they might flag up some wonky thinking that they've got. They might flag up some conditioning that they've got around, I don't know, identity or money or career, whatever it might be. They might have some strange beliefs going on around that. You know, we start to unpick things like your emotions, any stories that you've attached to, any past experiences that you've had in other workplaces that are affecting you now. So there's loads of stuff. I won't go through everything. We'll be here all day. But we start to unpick what is affecting my performance and behavior right now in this moment at work and in different scenarios, okay, whilst you're at work. The second question is, now I know what those things are, what can I do to take back control of those things that are affecting my performance and behavior at work? Okay. So that's the bit where we start to look more deeply at the beliefs that you have. We challenge those beliefs. We reprogram them if we need to. We might delve into some of that conditioning that you've got and really start to think about, well, where has that come from? And is it serving you? And if it isn't, what's a more impactful thing that would serve you in that area right now? So you're basically reprogramming any wonky thoughts, any belief systems that you've got, any conditioning that is really holding you back. That's what we're doing, in essence.
That does actually sound like I'm not super across this whole area, obviously. But in general, though, I'm like what you were saying at the start of that. When you were speaking just then about how you're different than to other people in the area. Does actually, like, I'm from my, you know, lay point of view, I can actually see that that's actually really different, because like just about every, like, in, it's probably not specifically in your area, but people who do or at least talk about a lot of similar things, who might be like HR people or like other people who are having similar conversations, but they're all, it's the focus is all on it's a lot on those other things you mentioned. And so it's like, that's really interesting, because that, from somebody who's hearing it kind of for the first time in how you're explaining it, that does make a lot more sense. Like, that makes more common sense to me, that that would be like the most logical, even just from their very clinical point of view, that seems like the most logical approach, because like you're going, like anything, if you're going to build a house, you don't start with the roof. You don't even start with the frame. Like, you start with the foundations, and then you've got to make, you know, you have to consider all these, like a bunch of other stuff first. Like, the soil, is the soil, are you building it on sand? Are you building it on like bedrock? Like all these other aspects. And I mean, that's a good, that's a good thing. Like, for just about anything. I mean, everyone relates to that, right? Everyone's like, yeah, of course you got it. Like, that's, why wouldn't you? So, I mean,
well, organizations are made up of individuals, right?
Yeah.
Organizations are made up of individual people. So why would you try and change the whole culture before you start to work on individuals, right? But here's the thing, right? Yeah. Organizations shy away from working on individuals because it's the unknown. They don't know what's going to come out of it. They fear the worst, right? And they go, oh, we're not prepared to invest in that. We'd rather focus on getting our team to work well together. But if a person doesn't understand themselves on their own, and then in a one-on-one conversation group scenario, you know, they've got to have that deeper awareness. So just going back to the third
step. That makes a lot of sense, though. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Just going back to the third step of the authentic self process, I'm conscious some listeners might be going, you said there's a third and you've not told me, so what is it, right? So we've got the awareness. So we call it raise. The first step is raise. So raising your awareness of the thoughts and the behaviours that affect your performance in the workplace. The second one is about releasing. So releasing any of that stuff and really taking back control and understanding how to do that. The third step is known as reconnect. So this one is then asking a different question. So now I've done all of that self-development work. Now I've raised my awareness. Now I've really understood who I am and how I'm showing up. What can I do to achieve my personal and professional goals at work? So this is about putting some really solid things in place to help you professionally and personally to grow and to develop. So we look at personal leadership strategies. And then we look at resilience, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of different techniques involved in that section. So they're the three points. And I think that's what sets us apart from everybody else out there that does anything to do with psychological safety, because we focus in on people, not processes.
That almost sounds, especially in the way you said it, Andrea, that sounded like the perfect sort of wrap-up part to like everything. It's like you planned that. That's
was
incredible.
Ever said. I did. Can I just
how
I
did you know? How did you, how did you know we were getting near the end of the podcast? That's incredible. But but then no, that was explained really well. And I hope everyone listening was sort of there's a bunch of different things in there. There's obviously a lot of things to unpack that you've been across like for a long while now, and it's kind of amazing really. Like I can only imagine what a juggling act that would be for some, like in some instances. So it's fascinating actually to me. And I didn't even realize it was going to be. So there you go. I was surprisingly fascinated. It's a school day. Thanks, Teach.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. So I'll just also ask you at this point too. I said at the start that ask you for a quote, Gina. So could you please articulate your quote or whatever you'd like to say surrounding that that you had arranged, pre-arranged?
Yeah. So my quote is this: take the leap. The other side is closer than you can imagine.
Mm.
So a friend gave me a bookmark with this quote on it. And it came at the time where I was contemplating leaving that toxic workplace behind. But I was really worried about taking the next step. And it got me thinking at the time. I was like, I kept playing it over and over. These words kept going over and over in my head. And that is what actually gave me the push to take a chance on the Institute. And my God, I haven't looked back since. So that's great. But these words have always stuck with me. And I try to share them as often as I can, because quite often people have like barriers to taking the next step, or they're worried about something. And I think, I guess it comes back to faith, really, knowing that whatever's meant to be will be. So take the leap. The other side is closer than you can imagine.
I think that's great. Yeah, it's also for me very much a part of the sort of the spirit of creative thinking too. It's like, because you constantly have to, and this is like, you know, exercises, whether it's like artistic pursuits or thinking about things, there's a constant, you know, lack of moving forward if you don't take what, you know, might be in the minds of some people as a risk. But it's that leap, because you don't know. And the only way you're going to find out is to try it, you know, and then test it.
Give it a go.
No, give another leap, you know. Now go back and forth.
Learn from it as well.
Just
learn from it, right?
Learn from it. And that's the key point, is that you can keep leaping, but you might just keep falling over and you don't actually learn. Mm.
Yeah, but, and that's the key, right? Take a leap. If it doesn't work, you've learned something. Get the learning from it. Extract the learning. Move on. Try something different. Nothing's really set in stone, is it? But we often think that our life is like set out for us, but it's not. We can experiment, we can be curious, you know, we can experiment, we can ask questions, we can, you know, explore. I like to think of myself as an adventurer in that respect.
I think you seem like a adventurer for sure. I actually saw this great, it relates to what we just said with trial and error and the importance of that. I saw this fantastic thing. It was just like one of those random clips on LinkedIn, and it was so good. It was just this and I don't know why it grabbed my attention, but it was the response from some a guy in a soccer team, this guy, and he had been asked some one of those really silly questions from a reporter about you've lost X amount of times this season with your team. Like, how's that working out for you? It was like a really, rude sort of question. And this guy gave the best, like, he didn't turn around and go, hey, you know, bleep, bleep, bleep. He didn't do any of that. This guy gave him the best, most, like, pointed but intelligent sort of critique and like lesson. It was so like articulate. It was brilliant. This guy was just like, he had this big long ramble, but it was just like, you know, so, you know, it was all about sport. It was like sport. It was like, what are you talking about? It was like, you know, have you said to like, you know, LeBron James that like, that he was doing a terrible job when, like, he won all these things, but the other, like, 90% of his whole career he didn't? Is he a loser? You know, and he gave this whole sort of series of things about trial and error, and that, like, you know, sport, and it's a mental exercise, and you're working as a team. Most of the time you lose, and then when you win, it's only because you've learned from all the lessons from when you lost, and all this.
Yeah.
And he gave him this big, long, like, lecture.
Brilliant.
And the guy was absolutely, and he kept on asking this guy, who was getting increasingly more and more meek. The journalist was getting, like, more and more, like, yes. And he kept on asking him, it was like, okay, so does that mean that guy is a loser? And this goes, no, you know, and am I saying the same thing?
Brilliant.
I was like, oh man, that's so good. But he didn't do it. It was, what was best about it was he didn't do it in, like, a really negative way or angry way. He was just like, you know, I don't understand what you're talking about. And then he just went on and on and on. And it was so nice, though, too. And then he ended with just like, you know, so that's why, you know, it was like you saying that to me, like, and then he reminded him too. He said, and also, I mean, Brian or whatever the guy's name was, he was like, and Brian, like, you asked me that same question last year. So I was like, now I want you to, and it was like his dad just like giving him the best lesson. It was like, you're a journalist. You're meant to be asking, like, intelligent questions about, and, like, and at the end of it, this guy was just absolutely silent. And I just
mortified, probably.
Yeah, but he did it in a really nice way still. But it was that's like, and what we're talking about earlier is you can be deliberate and do something with, like, real force, but mm-hmm. it be still nice, but it also make a very strong point. And I was like, that's like one of the best examples of I've seen somebody, you know, explain something in a strong response to something that was stupid.
Yeah,
I just wanted to share that because I just remembered that when we were talking about it, and I watched the whole thing. It went on for quite a few minutes. And I mean, when you start watching some things and you're like, eh, and you go and skip around, and I like stayed for the whole thing. It's like,
it got your attention.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent. So anyway,
love it.
But thank you, Gina, so much for being on the podcast. It's been really great.
You're very welcome.
Where do people go? Like, we'll have links in the description also, but could you tell people where they go to learn more about you and the Psychological Safety Institute?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I'm very active on LinkedIn. So if anybody would like to connect with me on there, feel free to do so. I'm guessing you'll put the link below, but it's my name, basically, Gina Batty. I write a lot of content on there, so a lot of educational stuff. So feel free to check that out. There's quite a good resource bank on there if you have a look at my feed. The other way to find out more about the Institute specifically is if you go to thepsi.global, that's our website. And we've got two different things going on there. So we've got one aspect of it, which is for businesses. And then we've also got the Academy, which is for business owners. So this is for a place that you can go if you are already in the world of ED&I or anything to do with inclusion, and you want to start having conversations with your clients about psychological safety. We deliver training courses to upskill people to be able to do that. So if you look under the Institute, you'll find the Academy, and that's where you'll find everything to do with anything to do with educational aspects for business owners as well. So
fantastic.
Check us out.
It's wonderful. Thanks again. It's been a real joy. Really, I'm super interesting. And it's great to be educated in a really interesting way on my own podcast. I love it.
I'm glad you've learned something. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah. And say goodbye to everyone, Gina. Bye, everyone.
Yeah. Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm waving, by the way. You can't see me, but I'm waving. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. See ya.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business podcast.